Today's episode is brought to you by Wise, the account that helps you manage your money around the world, which is huge for travelers. I've been a customer and a fan for 10 years. The Wise account helps you send, spend, and receive in different currencies fast, and they do it all without hidden fees or exchange rate markups. This service has been so critical for me in my life as a traveler, as a nomad, as somebody living abroad. And you can join 16 million customers and learn how the Wise account can help you out on the road at wise.com/travel. That's Wise, WISE.com/travel, or download the app. This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder with 7 drive modes. The Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
I totally understand that impulse to not hyper-specialize and really focus more on defining a mission for yourself in the world and pursuing that mission authentically in whatever form makes most sense to you.
That was a clip from my interview today with Nanjala Niebola. She's the author of a new book called Traveling While Black. We're celebrating Black History Month today on the podcast. I'm so excited to bring you this interview. We've got a ton packed into this show. First of all, I'm going to share with you one of my travel heroes, and then you're going to dive into this conversation with Nanjala. We cover so much ground, everything from giving back as a traveler to the impact that travel can have on your relationship with fear. We talk about privilege. There's a lot of destination stuff in here. Just a ton. So I know you're going to love the interview portion. I've also got a shout out to somebody in this community who gave me a suggestion for what to do with my patch collection. So you'll hear that. And loads more. We got to get into it because we got a lot to cover. It's happening now. So buckle up, strap in. Thanks for being here. And welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. And now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey, what's up? It's Jason with ZeroToTravel.com. Welcome to the show. Thanks for hanging out, letting me bring a little travel into your ears today. This is the show to help you travel the world on your terms to fill your life with as much travel as you desire, no matter what your situation or experience. Welcome, my friend. I hope this finds you healthy and happy. I know a lot of travelers are starting to either think about getting out there again or even starting to get out there. My buddy Travis and his family's down in Costa Rica. I've heard from some of you in the listening community that are out and about. Some of you have been out and about because you don't have anywhere to live. Shout out to all the nomads out there that have been keeping it going during this pandemic and just finding places to stay safe and hole up. And we're thinking about everybody out there in the listening community. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, I do have a shout out to somebody who dropped me a voicemail. I love to hear from listeners. And if you haven't checked in at all, shoot me a line, jason@zerototravel.com. I ask for voice messages if you can give me one, and you can just open up the audio app and send one. Or if you go to zerototravel.com/speak, you can easily leave a message. And that's what this guest did. And I'll share a little bit about that at the end, because she gave me a suggestion for my country's patch collection. And I think it's a good one. It was nice to hear from her. So that's coming up later. And of course, this wonderful interview with Nanjala. Before we get into that, I do want to talk about one of my travel heroes. You know, it's Black History Month. And I remember coming across this story last year and thinking, wow, what guts, what determination, what bravery this person had. This is a woman named Bessie Stringfield. She lived from, they're not sure, 1911 or 1912 to 1993. So she's no longer alive. I'm going to read you some a little bit about her from her Wikipedia page. She was an American motorcyclist who was the first African-American woman to ride across the United States solo and was one of the few civilian motorcycle dispatch riders for the U.S. Army during World War II. She's credited with breaking down barriers for both women and Jamaican-American motorcyclists. Stringfield was inducted into the Motorcycle Hall of Fame, the award bestowed by the American Motorcycle Cyclist Association for Superior Achievement by Female Motorcyclist is named in her honor. Bessie Stringfield, and one of my travel heroes. If you go down to read a bit more on the page, just put yourself in her shoes, right? It is, what's the year? 1930, okay? At the age of 16, she taught herself to ride a motorcycle. That was in 1928. And then in 1930, at the age of 19, she started traveling across the United States. And according to Wikipedia, she made 7 more long-distance trips in the U.S. and eventually rode through the 48 states, Europe, Brazil, and Haiti. And during this time, she actually earned money from performing motorcycle stunts in carnival shows. It says, due to her skin color, Stringfield was often denied accommodation while traveling, so she would sleep on her motorcycle at filling stations. Due to her sex, she was also refused prizes in flat track races she entered. So think about this. Just taking a solo trip like this and traveling around on a motorcycle is an adventure in and of itself. I'm sure even more so back in 1930. Now add to that the racial stuff she had to deal with, the racism and being a woman, which was at that time, it's probably not the most common thing that people would see. What an incredible person. I mean, this is why she is one of my travel heroes. So if you've never heard of her name, I just wanted to give some love to Bessie Stringfield. And you can look her up on her Wikipedia page. She had a fascinating personal life, some really interesting stuff about her. And wow, I mean, talk about love of travel, right? Doing it for the love of travel despite all those odds and, you know, figuring out a way to make your travel dreams a reality, I guess. You know, I wish, oh man, I would love to sit down and have a meal with Bessie and hear some stories from her. That would be a dream. Obviously, that's not possible. She's no longer alive, but definitely one of my biggest travel heroes. And a little bit of Black travel history for you here during Black History Month. Now, let's get into the interview today and stick around on the other side. One of the things that comes up in this interview is this idea of changing your relationship to fear, how travel can do that. And stick around for the after the interview segment, because I'll talk a little bit about that, share some personal thoughts. We'll leave you with a quote and, of course, a shout out to somebody in the listening community. So let's get into the interview now. Thanks again for listening. And I'll see you on the other side, my friend. So pleased and honored to welcome my guest today, Nanjala Niyabola, who has a new book out called Traveling While Black, which is an essay collection reflecting on race and human mobility in various forms. Nanjala, welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, you have a beautiful name.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's a name I'd never heard before. Do you know, is there like a meaning behind the name? Or
There is. It comes from my community in Western Kenya, and it means a girl born during the dry season, because I was born during the dry season. So in our communities, we don't really mark time by weeks or months or whatever. We mark it by events. So children get named by what time of the year they were born or what was happening in the world at the time when they were born. And then sort of time is measured relative to a person's age. So you would know, you know, this person was born and you would say like, oh, it's been 7 years since this person was born. And that would sort of give you a sense of time. So most of the kids who come from the community where I come from, we are named for seasons, time of the year, events, things like that.
Does that impact your sense of time now, like in the working world?
You know, it doesn't really affect my sense of time. I think what it does affect is, you know, it's, I think that Nanjala is an easy name, but I notice a lot of people struggle with it. And because it's also, it's a very heavy name. It actually, the full literal translation is a girl born during the time of hunger. And so it's a heavy name. And I remember Warsan Shira, who is this Kenyan British Somali poet. She's brilliant. She has this poem where she says, you know, give your daughters difficult names. And it's a long poem about, you know, preparing women, I guess, for the world and things like that. And I've always held that poem very close to my heart because I feel like that's the kind of name that I have. And it's the kind of name that forces, as she says in the poem, it forces people to stop and think about how they're speaking to you or what they're saying to you. And it forces people to stop and think. So in that way, yes, it definitely affects my sense of being in the world. But no, I mean, I'm an urban kid, so it doesn't really affect my sense of time. I do have a terrible sense of time, though. just for the record.
You and me both. You and me both. Maybe it's a traveler thing. I don't know.
It's a traveler thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned the words you used is a heavy name, and I'm certainly some of the subject matter that you take on, not only in your book, but just through your work. I mean, you have such varied experience. I've been reading through the book and watching some videos of you. I watched your TED Talk and some of the other talks you've given, and I mean, you could say you're a writer, you're an activist, you're a political analyst, all these things. I wasn't really quite sure how to describe your many talents and the work that you do in the world. So I want to ask you, how would you describe your work?
I'm a person who is trying, who likes understanding how things work and who is trying to use that knowledge to make the world better for as many people as possible. And that sometimes takes me on interesting tangents because I don't believe in the idea of specialization or hyper-specialization. I never have. When I was in school, I was very good at sciences, and now I'm a writer. So I feel like in the modern world, we are always being pushed to be very good at one thing, and I'm just not always sure that that's the best thing. I mean, look at some of the biggest thinkers in history. You know, you look at someone like Michelangelo. Michelangelo was an artist and an inventor and a writer, and all of those things spoke to each other, right? All of those things made him better. Maya Angelou was a dancer, a poet, a political activist, and did all of these things that spoke to each other and made her whole, the sum total of her life experience, deeper. Edward Said was a filmmaker, was a concert pianist, was a literary critic, was a politician. So I feel like I totally understand that impulse to not hyper-specialize and really focus more on defining a mission for yourself in the world and pursuing that mission authentically in whatever form makes most sense to you. And that's how I end up doing a lot of different things because they all bring something new to the sum total of my experience, just like when you're traveling, right? If you just go to a place and only do one thing, are you really getting the full experience of that place? Or do you have to do different things, you know, go to the theater, then go to a show and then walk around the streets and then have dinner in a high-end restaurant and then have dinner on a street food cart, things like that, in order to get a sense of what a place is. I kind of think about life in similar terms.
Yeah, and the idea of kind of filtering these things through your one mission statement, right? Or like the driving force behind all of your work. I think it's such a great way to approach it because a lot of times, you know, when you're a curious person and you want to impact the world in different ways, you have different things that are speaking to you, right? And sometimes, you know, you're only one person, there's only so much time, right? So you have to choose to ignore some of those things and listen to some of them. And, you know, for you, I mean, writing this book, what was the driving force for that? Like, how did that rise above all the other things you may have done during that time?
The book represents, it's also very eclectic approaches in terms of the different approaches that it takes because it reflects the eclectic experiences that I've had with travel and human mobility. So I've worked in refugee law, so I have a law degree. I've worked in policy work, but I've also been to about 70 different countries over the last 12 years. And all of those things might seem completely disconnected from a removed place. But for me, as the person who's living in them, I saw them connected as wanting to experience as much of the richness and fullness of the human experience as I possibly could. Just basically eat life with a big spoon. And I got so frustrated professionally because I kept running into this unspoken barrier that was very palpable to me as a Black African woman. And there were all these things that were happening that we couldn't call racism and we couldn't name racism because of the way in which bureaucratic jargon works, right? So you come up with a more elaborate, fancy term for it. And you say, well, what we're doing right now is, this is a returns policy. And I'm like, well, these are human beings. These are not, you know, light bulbs that you got at Target that you are returning because you didn't like them. These are people that you're turning away because, you know, you don't want to accept them or provide help to them. And so that was one thread. And then the other thread was that I had been traveling extensively and feeling the world getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And so again, with an African passport, the places where I can just show up are so few. And yet my professional life kept demanding, and even my personal life, you know, that impulse that travelers have to sort of keep going and keep experiencing, it was growing and growing and growing, but the world kept feeling like it was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And the visa requirements were getting longer and longer and more elaborate and more invasive and more even, you know, structurally violent. And so the impulse really came from, at this point, looking back, wanting to look back on the previous 12 years and bottle that feeling of the world getting smaller for someone who is both trying to experience it fully and who is witnessing some of the most vulnerable communities in the world coming up against this push, this struggle. And like, so for example, I have an essay about going to Palermo and it weaves from my personal experience of trying to get to Italy, right, and having to exploit a long visa that had taken, getting that visa, I call it a visa window in the book, getting that visa had involved 3 months of bank statements and, you know, proof that you have a home here. As a single, Africans get turned down for visas to Europe at a rate of like 60 or 70%. My only reason why I got it was because my job, my company was an American company that was sponsoring the visa. And so I had tried to volunteer with refugees in Lampedusa and in Greece for many times. And I had been rejected because you can't work on, and I didn't need a paid job. I wanted to volunteer. I had a paid job. But the idea was that basically we can't give you this visa because you're an African and we don't trust you. We don't trust you to go home when you're done, even though I had, you know, lived abroad and gone home multiple times. And so that's why the essay kind of oscillates between my personal experience and then what I was witnessing with the arrival of these migrant ships. And then also going into this community of young people in Palermo who was resisting the policies that were coming down from Milan and coming down from Rome, because they live with this migrant crisis and with human beings, and they want to stop this policy of allowing people to die on the high seas. And there was no way that I felt that I could write that essay without putting myself in it and without bringing all of these different pieces together. Because I think together they make up this unique viewpoint that I hope is going to be crucial to putting a human face to the people that we label, you know, travelers, migrants, refugees, other. And that people will start having conversations that are a little bit more empathetic.
You know, what you're describing is this idea of privilege, right? Whether it's a privileged passport or, you know, you get visa privileges or white privilege and race privilege, something like that, that it's, if you're on the receiving end of that in terms of like, you don't have those types of issues, you can become blind to the struggles that other people are experiencing because you haven't experienced them yourselves. And I think like one of the things we're trying to do here is to like obviously bring awareness to privilege. I think that's an important step, to just like become aware that these privileges exist. What can we as individuals kind of do to start creating change, more change?
You know, that's one of the things that that's why I had the section on. So I don't know if I should say spoiler alert, spoiler alert, in the Palermo essay. That's why I felt it was important. So I had been there for these a couple of days, about a week in southern Italy, and really not wanting to do anything except witness and just be present and start to see the human faces behind all of these numbers and statistics that I had been seeing in the press and that had been devastating enough in that abstract sense, but you know, to see it and to be able to process it better. And then at the end of it, I go back to my Airbnb and I speak to the person who I had rented there. He was very curious about why I was there as a young man. Why are you here? Did you have a good time? You know, and I, you know, got into a conversation with him and he was like, I wish I'd known that that's what you're here for, because I'm part of this anarchist collective that is trying to push back against the inhumane migration policies. And I was so surprised by that. I was literally like, because everything that you read about in the news is always so, you know, pardon the cliche, but it's always so black and white. It's always these people against these people. But I think what I saw was individual people operating in a system that was making it harder for people to speak up on the side of justice and fairness. And so what I hope that people can start to do when they read this book is to see the space for individual action, even when the system is so, you know, rigid and the space is getting smaller and smaller. Those guys in Palermo, they just literally would, yeah, I went to their meeting after we had this conversation with my Airbnb host. It was like, look, I know your flight's early in the morning, but come to our meeting, come and listen in and see what happens. And so I sat in on this meeting with, they were so to have a conversation with me, you know, and to say, we are not, our government isn't really speaking on our behalf here, and we're doing what we can to make space for things to be different. And I hope that that's what individuals take from this, that privilege, giving up privilege is not easy. Being conscious of your privilege and interrogating it and putting it down in favor of the greater good is not easy, but it's the right thing to do, because a more just system is better for all of us. And so you might lose, you know, your 20% of privilege, but the person who gains that 20% privilege means we are more equal and there's less of the extremes that we're seeing in the world today. And I think people can miss that even though the structure is so big and elaborate, you do have agency. You do have the power to influence it. And just on a very basic level, like what those guys were doing in Palermo, gather, raise awareness, have the conversations, be uncomfortable, and be willing to give up some of your comfort in the favor of the greater good, in favor of the greater good.
This episode of Zero to Travel is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. We're excited to partner with Nissan because our listeners know we love to celebrate the joy of exploring the world and finding the best off the beaten path destinations to visit. And there's no better vehicle for that than the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys, and it even has the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds, so you can bring the fun with you. But Nissan also knows that it's not just about where you go. In a Pathfinder, the real fun comes from getting there, and that's something we love celebrating here on the Zero to Travel podcast. We believe that life is about finding that joy within the journey itself, and that's why we're thrilled to partner with Nissan to celebrate adventurers everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of Zero to Travel and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. If you love coffee like me, let me tell you how you can get an incredible cup of coffee, whether you're at home or on the road. You can use what I use, which is the AeroPress. Have you seen this? This is a device that uses a patented 3-in-1 brew technology. It combines the flavor benefits of espresso, pour over, and French press into one compact, portable device built for travel or home. The AeroPress has over 55,000 five-star reviews in 60 countries. Plus, it's the best-reviewed coffee press on the planet. That tells you something. And it makes an incredible gift. Under 50 bucks. Get one for yourself or somebody you care about. Pick yours up at aeropress.com/zero to travel. That's AeroPress, AeroPress.com/zero to travel. Use the promo code zero to travel, all one word, to save 20% off your order. That's 20% off. Thank you to AeroPress for the delicious coffee and for supporting today's show. Yeah, a word that you've used a few times already, and I've noticed in the book as well, which is really tying in with travel in terms of just witnessing or being a witness, is this concept of what does that mean to you when you say that I'm there to witness?
I feel like there's often this idea that if you have privilege, your job is to save people. And I don't like that idea. I think that that is what has made the aid, you know, the development, that space where I was working for so many years, that's what has made it really difficult to have true justice, that your job is not to save people. Your job is to make room for people to save themselves. And sometimes that doesn't mean coming in and prescribing a path. Sometimes that means getting, absorbing as much information as you possibly can and helping other people make sense of situations and see the fullness of the situation. So when I went to Palermo, when I go to, you know, Burkina Faso, when I go to all of these places, when I think about, you know, what's happening in the townships in South Africa, I don't see my role as I'm telling you about all of this stuff because I think I'm going to save all of these people. I am not so arrogant as to believe that I can save the world, but I do think that I can make room for the world to be fairer, and I can make room for people to work together. That's the quote that I use in the book that I love. I've always loved it. It says, if you have come to save me, then you are wasting your time. But if you have come because you believe that your liberation is connected to mine, then let us work together. And so it's really powerful, isn't it? And so I think that my job is to help us work together and show places where we can work together. And that's what witnessing is to me, is just so that, and also so that people, I feel like one of the most awful experiences a human being can have is that anonymous death, you know. And I think of all the people who are walking across the desert and struggling and in cages, you know, in the southern US border and on boats in the Mediterranean Sea and on boats in the Indian Ocean. And I just think of how frustrating that, and that's part of the reason why I had that essay on Bessie Head, because she was stateless. She was a refugee and she suffered the same indignities that we are subjecting thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people to. And it turned out that she was one of the best writers, most brilliant writers ever. Can you imagine how much amazing genius and talent and creativity is getting lost on the high seas? The couple that came up with the COVID vaccine are children of Turkish refugees, right? The couple who came up with the big vaccine. So it's things like that that I hope I am pushing people to start to see in a human way and not just numbers.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. And
but there's also funny stories. I feel like.
Well,
I mean. So, like, I tried to.
Well, I mean, this is what I love about the book, though. You know, a lot of quote unquote travel books are, you know, it's really the perspective of the sort of the person passing through, the traveler. And I feel like what you've done here with these essays is you're more, like you said, the world's becoming smaller in these ways. I mean, we're all connected and you're really just integrating all of these world issues and your perspectives in with your travels, which is, I mean, to me, a more, I don't know the word. I hate sometimes to put words to things because I don't want to say like authentic or holistic or whatever the word is, way to kind of approach travel. Like you're there to witness, but also acknowledge, right? Like what the realities of the world. There's more to it than just, getting the good picture for Instagram, right?
Yeah. And I'm so glad you said that, because that was really something that was important to me, was that I think those of us who travel, the way in which the travel space is organized, our momentum is just keep going, keep moving forward, keep moving forward, keep moving forward. Don't stop and reflect, get the Instagram picture, tell everybody that you were there, and don't connect it to anything else, right? I went to, what's that, Santorini, and I got a picture with the white walls, and it's all over my Instagram, and now I'm done. And I think that we don't realize that, first of all, we're having a very unusual experience of the world, that travel doesn't come naturally to everybody, and the ability especially to travel and be in another society and not just, you know, go to a resort and you know, have this sort of sheltered experience, but it's not necessarily the experience that everybody's able to have. And so I translate that as, okay, then how can I make this travel part of the story of the world? How do I connect this to the stories of the world? And so that it's not just an individual solitary experience, but it's part of myself, understanding myself and helping other people witness and helping other people understand the world. I was very deliberate about this in the introduction, and you know, I just know not everybody, if everybody in the world traveled the way I do, first of all, the environment would be a complete disaster. And secondly, you know, I mean, it wouldn't be sustainable. But at the same time, we do need people to go into other cultures and help us make sense of each other, because we're part of this connected tapestry, right? So that was really important to me. And I tried to break up the really heavy stuff. You know, I write about peeing, and I write about sunrises in Burkina Faso, and I try to break up the really heavy global stuff with the fact that there's also small stuff that is profound in a different way, and I hope that that's what people see, because that's what travel is to me, is sometimes it's showing up and you're staring at one of the seven wonders of the world, and then other times it's watching a sunset with a person who, you know, you don't share the same language, but you both understand that this is a spectacular sunset. Like, there's profundity in the big things and in the little things too, and it's all connected and it's all part of the story.
Yeah, I wrestle with that sometimes, the idea that you brought up, and I read that in the book, and I was glad that you acknowledged that the potential, you know, environmental impact of travel, for example, or like you saying that it wouldn't be sustainable if everybody was doing it. And, you know, as I got older and maybe a bit more, hopefully a little wiser, and I had a little more travel under my belt, it almost seemed unfair to acknowledge that and to like kind of preach that here. Well, yeah, sure, I got to do all these things before, but, you know, it's just become more and more a part of my decision-making process, you know, how, you know, the impact this trip is going to make, or this potential trip, like, is it, you know, is it worth it? And I don't know. It's sometimes it's a difficult thing to reconcile.
Yeah. But you know, that's the reason why I had that essay on the DRC and the mobile phones, because that's the thing, that's the wrestling that I wanted to put on the table, because I don't know the answer. I haven't figured it out. Like, if the pandemic ended tomorrow and someone gave me a round the world plane ticket, would I say no? Absolutely not. I would be right, first in line at the airport, in the morning, let's go.
Backpack on, ready to go.
Ready to go. I know where all my stuff is. I could be packed in 30 minutes. But I can't pretend not to know, right? So I know the environmental cost, and I know, and it would be incredibly disingenuous and harmful to pretend not to know. And so what I wanted to do with that essay was exactly that, was to show people that you running away from that tension is not the answer. But maybe we can start to think about conscious travel and conscious consumption, and how do we atone you know, for the damage that we're doing, because we are doing damage, even if our intentions are good. How do we make amends for that? And how do we help towards the world's healing? So like with the mobile phone, you know, where I settled in is like, I like my my fancy camera, and I like my, you know, fancy apps. And so I have a nice phone, but I don't replace it every year. And I try not to replace it every year. And I try to be careful with it so that at the very least, I'm trying to make amends for the damage that might have gone into owning this object and what it represents. And that's kind of, I think more travelers, we really have to start thinking consciously about the way we are consuming the world. If a bus is an option, do I have to fly? If cycling is an option, do I need to rent a car? Can I walk? Can I, you know, contribute to an environmental group in the country that I'm going to? Can I be part of the solution? In as much as the traveling has made me part of the problem, there's a map that, you know, the flight radar sort of tracks every flight in the world. And there was a map that came out over Thanksgiving weekend in the United States. And it was horrifying because all the experts had said, don't go home for Thanksgiving. And yet the sky was full of planes, you know, during Thanksgiving. And I thought about that. And I thought, if people won't even make these tough choices in the face of a pandemic, how do we normalize making these tough choices when everything is as close to fine as we can get as a species? I don't have the answer. I hope that I've started people on the process of asking the right questions.
Yeah. It's the essay you're referring to is Small Acts of Resistance, correct? Which I love the title of that. I mean, and the spirit behind it.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's so easy to be moralistic about these things. But I feel like if those of us who know were a little bit, I'm hoping that the essay comes across as a little bit more gentle and more of an invitation to reflect rather than a lecture. And an invitation to reflect from someone who is also grappling with those issues and who is also trying to figure it out. And I hope that that's what people get from that particular essay.
Yeah, I think the word that seemed to be going around is conscious, right? And this idea of being conscious, right? Like you said, it doesn't mean that you're not going to own a cell phone, but do you have to replace it every year? You know, whether it's travel or whether it's consumption, all of that, if you're conscious of it, I feel like you do make different decisions, right? If you're thinking with the mindset of, okay, yeah, I'm taking this, what you said, the round the world plane ticket that they're giving me. Okay, but like, what can I do to give back from that experience, you know? Mm-hmm. And I also think like the alternative sometimes, like you mentioned, oh, should I, you know, could I cycle instead of take the bus or whatever? Like sometimes those alternatives actually enhance the travel experience, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely. One of my favorite trips, it didn't make the book because it's one of those that would require an entire book of its own, was I flew to Cape. I was living in Amsterdam at the time, and I flew to Cape Town, and then I used local buses to drive from Cape Town to Nairobi, and so that's about 5,500 kilometers in about 3 weeks. It was phenomenal in the retrospect, but I'll tell you what, when I got to Zambia, which was four countries in, so I'd been to South Africa, I'd been to Botswana, three countries in, I was tired. I was so tired. And I really thought, oh my gosh, I can't sit on another rickety bus for 12 hours, 18 hours. And it was a point of struggle with these questions, is that I had committed myself to doing this trip in a specific way, because using public transit as opposed to hiring a vehicle, as opposed to being one person in a rental car, as opposed to, you know, like, I really had committed myself to this cost, both for cost reasons, but also to trying and experiencing how local communities move. it was a really difficult decision. I really wanted to get on a plane and just go back. But I'm glad that I forcing that conscious consumption framework, as you've said, forced me to look at my decisions differently. That it wasn't just about my comfort, but it was also about, okay, but in the big scheme of things, how does this fit in with the kind of values that you're trying to abide by? And, you know, got up in the morning and took that 15-hour drive and 12 hours, but ended up stopping somewhere where I hadn't planned to stop because I was tired. And that's somewhere that I turned to stop was one of the most amazing places. It's on Lake Malawi, and it's called Nkata Bay. And it's this beautiful, tiny fishing village on Lake Malawi, which is the equivalent. Lake Malawi covers the equivalent of 1/3 of Malawi's landmass. So it's a huge lake. But Malawi is also a small country. And it still remains one of the most beautiful, wonderful experiences that I've ever had. It's just the most serene fishing village with a little tourist community, and there's diving and there's boating and all of that stuff. And I wouldn't have had that experience if I hadn't sort of tried to reconcile what this trip would look like in retrospect with regards to the values that I was trying to live by in my own life.
Right. Yeah. You set yourself up for that in a way, unknowingly, I guess, just by, like you said, abiding by your values. I mean, do you have a list of, like, you've ever written out what your personal values are, or do they just...
So I don't really have values written down. But the most important thing for me is to try and be a good person and to try not to leave the world better than, in some way, better than I found it. And that sort of then sort of creates whole levels of secondary values and tertiary values and everything. Every day you're making choices, But also, and I guess tied to that is the idea that you do have the power. I do have the power to make choices. I don't just have to accept things because that's how they were given to me and that's how they were told to me. I can choose. We can all choose. We can all choose to do things differently and do things better. And I hope that we do.
Yeah, see things differently, right? I mean, that's I think one of your many gifts is just the ability to kind of question things, right? Or look at it from a different perspective. I saw on Twitter you wrote, "My aim is to use my experiences of travel to try to get people to have more nuanced conversations about human mobility," and you know, how do we get more people in power to open their hearts and their borders to asylum seekers?
That's a fantastic question. And I think it starts with us in our communities, in our homes, in our families, really upholding and uplifting the idea that every single person that is on that boat, that is walking across the desert. And again, that was one of the things that I was trying to do with this book, was to show how I have this entire story behind me, but I show up at that border and I am, quote unquote, just an African woman. And if we, whenever you see this, they do these surveys from time to time, or you see these stories from time to time of how a community could have voted in favor of the anti-immigration candidate, and then the police come for the neighbor, their migrant neighbor, and they're like, no, we didn't mean this guy. We meant all of the other ones. We meant all the bad ones, but not our guy. It's like, well, your guy, that other person is someone else's person and is a brother and a sister and whatever. So when the person is the character of the asylum seeker, the migrant, the refugee, is a human person that we can situate in our communities, we tend to be gentler about them. We tend to be more empathetic about them. We being the ordinary people. I mean, there's obviously the extreme racist, the extreme violent person who, you know, is not necessarily in this matrix, but I'm talking about ordinary people who are not motivated by hate and who are not necessarily motivated by racism. When we see these people as not as numbers or as vague threats that are articulated by political parties or as whatever it is that power is trying to tell us who they are, we tend to be kinder about it and more empathetic about it. And so I feel like that's where we begin. We begin by reclaiming the humanity of the refugee, the migrant, the asylum seeker from political jargon and abstraction and make them human in our storytelling and in our engagements with our families and our communities, and then speak up for them. Because another reason why I wanted to do this was I felt that there were so many people who, if they saw how these things were connected, would be more vocal publicly in defense of the traveler in all the forms, the person who is on the move in every form that they present themselves into their community. Sorry, it's a long-winded answer, but I always, when I arrive at borders, especially European borders, I always have this, there's always this moment of, first, they're looking for a reason to exclude before they're looking for a reason to include. And then there's this moment where they get my passport and they start to go through the passport because I have a lot of stamps in their passport. And they're like, oh, I didn't it's not verbalized, but you see the shift, you feel the shift of, I didn't realize that you were quote unquote good. And I want us to challenge that framework, because just because a person has had all of these opportunities, and other people haven't, doesn't make them more worthy than other people. We have to treat people with empathy and respect the character of the traveler, the migrant, the refugee, as a human person who has a whole story behind them, even if that story doesn't necessarily conform to our preset values about worthiness. You know, this person went to a good school. This person is a doctor. I had a cab driver in Munich once who was an Iraqi doctor. And, you know, he's a cab driver. And we started to talk broken Arabic and his perfect Arabic. And he is just like, a lot of people don't speak to me, you know, I'm just a background figure. And I was like, well, you know, I'm new here as well. So I'm very curious about, and taxi drivers are the easiest way. And he was saying, he really brought that message home. He was like, well, I always wonder, you know, I have this, I'm going back to Iraq and I'm doing this and I sent money and I'm doing this. And people don't always ask me about that. So this is what I hope that people will start to do. This is why I think we have to start allowing things to be complicated and allowing people to be complicated and empathizing more with each other.
Hmm. Yeah. And part of that is being the witness, right? Like choosing to say, I choose to participate, to engage with this individual, be a witness in their life and their life experience, and to learn from that. I mean, it's one of the beautiful things about travel, you know, is to meet somebody like that, you just would never meet that person in your, you know, if you're hanging around in your hometown, the chances are probably slim, right?
Probably slim. And you would see, and everything again, another reason why I spend two or three chapters talking about different African countries is everything that there was about that person, you would have received filtered through a lens that is trying to tell you a very specific story about that person. So everything, if you ask people what they know about Iraq, many people in many parts of the world wouldn't even be able to find Iraq on the map. But they would be able to tell you about the war and terror and bombs and things like that. And I was talking to a Christian Iraqi doctor in fact, my first Arabic teacher was also Iraqi woman from Basra, an English teacher. And she was telling me, you know, everybody thinks about Iraq as this really fragmented place, and it didn't have a perfect history. But I'll tell you what, we were the most religiously pluralistic society in the Gulf. That Iraq was a place where you could be a Christian in a teaching, you know, in your department with Muslims, with, you know, Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims, and they had a significant Jewish population in Iraq and for a long time, not towards the end of Saddam Hussein's rule. But there was a complicated place that wasn't just defined by war and wasn't just defined by conflict. And now that all gets consumed by this media spin cycle and things like that. So how do we get people to not process other parts of the world in simple sound bites and simple narratives, I think travel is one of the easiest way to do that. That having that person who goes and witnesses and experiences and comes back and says, you know what, it was so much more than just what you see in the press. It was actually a really complicated and fun and interesting and dynamic place.
Here's a quick powerful exercise. If you think about one or two of your big goals, and then you fast forward a few months from now, what can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If one of those goals for you is learning a new language, or even just a little bit of a language to enhance your next trip, you should absolutely get Babbel. They have quick 10-minute lessons handcrafted by over 200 language experts. You can actually start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. It's designed by real people for real conversations, exactly what you want as a traveler. I just downloaded it and went into the Norwegian course area thinking, oh, I've got this. Immediately made a bunch of grammar mistakes that they corrected, and I was like, oh, I've been doing this wrong. So I'm already leveling up and learning, and you can get Babbel now. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/zerototravel. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/zerototravel, spelled babbel.com/zerototravel. Rules and restrictions may apply. Thank you to Babbel for supporting today's show. Hey, you lovely listeners, Jason here. And did you know we have a newsletter and it's free? You can sign up over at zerototravel.com/newsletter. You're going to get money-saving tips, destination advice, some musings, little personal updates, all the stuff that you don't get right here on the podcast. And we can keep in touch. So sign up over there, zerototravel.com/newsletter. Get your weekly dose of travel value, totally free. Thanks for listening. This is something I was going to go right into next, which is the media, because I feel like this, these sweeping generalizations or a lot of these narratives can come on a mass scale from the media. And, you know, it can make it harder in some ways for people to empathize on an individual level, because it's a... I don't even know what to say about the media right now with the internet and how it is. I wouldn't even begin to want to like figure out the solution to how we can change the media. But I mean, I'd like to have the discussion. I mean, that was something I wanted to ask you. I mean, I think a good framework to have this discussion might be, you know, the media representation of your home continent, perhaps. Right? Like, if you want to have the dialogue, and I mean, I would just love to hear your thoughts as somebody who's worked with this. Yeah.
Both as a practitioner and as a person, as a storyteller, and as a person who is part of the story that's being told. And I will say this, one of the main back and forth sort of that I had with my editor was, we have two chapters in the book that are very much about three that are very much about Africa without Europe, without the West. And this was a very deliberate choice on my part, because one of the philosophies that I have in my academic work, in my intellectual practice, is Africa is not the anti-Europe. Because I think what happens is people get lazy. So you saw what happened with the coronavirus. When things happened and Europe sort of cases went through the roof, everybody started to say, well, if it's this bad in Europe, it's going to be terrible in Africa. And if it's this bad in America, it's going to be awful in Africa. And it hasn't been. It hasn't been awful. It's been difficult and things are complicated. But the idea that underlies a lot of media coverage of Africa has always been that Africa is everything that Europe, especially, but the West more generally, is not. This unspoken Conrad, Heart of Darkness, and I talk a little bit about this in the introduction. And so one of the challenges that I set for myself as a writer, always as a storyteller, is how can I tell stories about Africa in which Africa is not set up as what Europe is not? And that's why those three chapters are in there, is to see that we are complicated, and Africa is a complicated place, and it's a complicated place full of humans, not magical people who are here to save. You know, a lot of people come to Africa and African countries on trips, and they post on their Instagram about how they hugged a poor kid and now their life has changed. And you know, that Africa's place in the Western mythology is to save Westerners from themselves and, you know, let go of your materialistic whatever. And I just think that's insert expletive, because we're people. And we are people riddled with the same complexities and the same joys and the same hopes and frustrations that anybody anywhere else is. And that's where the media really fails. The foreign media, I would say, but even African media to some extent, that's where we really fail African people, because we try and either have these tropes confirmed or we are writing against the tropes. But whether you're confirming the trope or writing against the trope, you're still working within the limits that are defined by the trope, right? And so that's what I want. I think that's where the solution begins. Let African people and African societies be complicated. We are. And in your storytelling, let us be complicated. Allow for things to not always fit neatly into the preset categories that you're either writing about or writing against. When we talk about human mobility, there's always that absence of, well, how did Africans do borders before, you know, Western security apparatus sort of tells us Muslims are this and Christians are that. You know, like, I live in a country that is 30% Muslim, and I grew up in a neighborhood in the city where I had neighbors who were Bora Muslims and Ahmadi Muslims and Sunni Muslims. I knew more about Islam than even if I went to a university in the United States. I, as a high school student, I would have been able to give a lecture on the different types of Islam that exist, because I grew up in a pluralistic society. But now we are importing this war on terror stuff, and they're telling us that, you know, Muslims are this and Christians are that. And so these stories start to creep into the story that we tell ourselves about this country that we live in. This is a pattern that's repeating itself across Africa, and it's not our story. So how do we, instead of, you know, uncritically consuming those stories that we're being told, how do we actually tell the truth about who we are, about the fact that, you know, Sudan is not just that Christianity was established in Sudan in the 6th century, and some of the oldest Christian religious frescoes in the world are in the Nuba region of Sudan, and that the Nubian community in Sudan built pyramids long before the Egyptians did, and that actually the pyramids in Egypt are modeled on the pyramids of Meroe, that steel comes from Meroe that was first forged in Africa, this metal that has changed the industrial world was first forged in Sudan. Like, let African stories, let African communities be complicated and be rich and be diverse in our histories. Africa is not just the anti-Europe. It's actually a really fascinating and complicated place on its own terms, for better or for worse. And my hope is that those chapters show people that it's that complexity, that it's not always cut and dry.
Yeah, I mean, and this is part of that, right? Like, your willingness to share stories, to put the time and effort you put into your work. And for us, or those of you listening, hey, pick up this book, right? Traveling While Black, or, like, you know, like, I know you mentioned somewhere, I can't remember where I read it, that you spent, maybe it was in the book actually, where you spent a year not reading any books written by white men for 1 year. I think this is a wonderful idea. So you can all start with this book.
Yes, please. I mean, I like it, but, you know, I know the author. So.
How has travel changed your relationship with fear, if it has?
Completely. When people who see me today, people who've known me my whole life, they don't recognize me. I was always the person who checked everything, checked it twice, checked it a third time, and then ended up not doing it anyway. I was always coloring within the lines, you know, do the right thing, hyper cautious, because we live in a very, Kenya is a very risk-averse society. This is one of the things that comes from living in, growing up working class millennial in Africa meant that you grew up at a time when everything was shrinking. So we had economic collapse in the 80s, and then everything started to shrink. The universities got smaller, and the space basically for a middle class, working class life got so much smaller. And so this constant fear that you might lose anything is one of the thing, everything, and especially, you know, in the shadow of the HIV/AIDS pandemic, this conscious precarity is what defines the African millennial experience in a lot of African countries. And so we are, a lot of us are raised to be hyper cautious, because you don't know if you might just lose everything on a heartbeat. And when I started to travel, I started to contend with a lot of the things, limits that I had put on myself that didn't necessarily reflect the reality of the world. And a great example is at the end of that, when I started that Cape to Nairobi trip, I was terrified. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to find. I don't know how. I had no plan. This was the first time I had done a cross country. No, it was the second time I'd done this multi-country trip, but it was like, all I knew was that I had to be in Nairobi at a certain date. Everything else was being fully improvised. And I got there and I started to take the first bus, then the second bus, then the third bus. And it slowly starts, you realize that people are doing this every day. Like, people are taking buses from Kaburone to Walvis Bay every day, thousands of people, and they get there.
You're just one of them that day, right?
You're just one of them that day. And I was like, this is a revelation.
That's so awesome.
And now I'm, that little shift has just changed the game completely, not just with regards to travel, but with regards to life. We are told to be afraid of things. And some fear is good, right? Because some fear is the reason why, for example, we are being cautious about a pandemic and we're being cautious about crossing the street. You know, look both ways. And what I've learned is how to calibrate fear and how to put it in its rightful place. Don't let it paralyze you. Don't let it make you do nothing. Make it part of your motivation, in one way or the other. Sort of sit with the fear and don't run away from it, but try and figure out how to make it fit into your journey. Nelson Mandela has a great quote in his book, A Long Walk to Freedom. And he says, I had learned that bravery was not the absence of fear, but the ability to act in spite of it. And I think that's the most important thing that travel teaches anybody, that especially backpacking, if you're doing it in a conscious way, is you're never going to fully stop being afraid of being by yourself in a new place. But bravery is really the ability to work with that fear and to not let it stop you from moving.
I love how you said that applies to travel and life, right? I mean, we could just leave it out at that. But that simple concept of like, hey, thousands of people are doing this every day, you know, whether it's riding a bus or starting a business, right?
Yeah.
Who says that you can't be one of them?
You should be one of them. We'll be one of them.
Or writing a book, which is no small thing.
Or writing a book, or, you know, being on a podcast like this.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love that. What's something new you recently learned about yourself?
Oh, wow. Isn't that a fantastic question? There's so many levels that I could go. Let me keep it like we've had such a heavy conversation. I think one of my, this is my second book. In the course of writing both of my books, I realized that I can only listen to one song when I'm working on a project. So the song kind of has the spirit of whatever I'm trying to do. And so there's a song on my iPod that I've listened to 1,000 700 times. And so that I didn't realize until when I was after the first book. And then it happened again. And I was like, this is weird, man. But I can't change the song. And if it's an essay, if it's like an essay for a magazine, or if it's like a book project, I will only listen to one song.
What song is it? You got to tell us.
each piece is different. Each piece has its own song. So it just depends on how I'm trying to get into what vibe I'm trying to get into with the book. And sometimes it's rap, and sometimes it's hip hop, and sometimes it's classical music. And the weird part is I never know which song it's going to be. But then when I have the song and I'm at my desk, I'm like, okay, this is the song. And it sticks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. I'm going to try that. Like, I mean, that the sort of the natural version of that might be like for me to, you know, if you're going to the gym or something, you're like, all right, I'm going to listen to like some hype music that pumps me up. But I haven't really thought about applying that to work, right? Like, all right, I'm going to write on this topic. So let me see what could be like my soundtrack.
Yeah.
Right?
I think what happens is that it becomes kind of like meditation. That it becomes like a constant in the background, and sort of gets your writing at the tempo of the thing. I think so. I mean, this is all like I genuinely don't have like a well reasoned answer to it. But it just when I noticed it, I was like, this is weird.
yeah. Do you ever struggle with the creative side, like remaining in the travel experience versus kind of what's going on in your head and thinking about, oh, I might write about this. Like, I might be inspired to write about this later. Let me think about like how that would be. Do you ever have that struggle as like somebody who's writing about travel?
Not in pure terms. And the reason why is that I journal, and I've been journaling for 22 years now, 21 years now. And so that kind of takes the pressure off, because I know that the ideas will be on the page in some form. And then I just have to go back to it at some point. And that anxiety, it relieves you of that anxiety of if I have to write it down and otherwise I'll forget. But I will say this, I was reading Toni Morrison's book, Mouthful of Blood, her last collection. And there's a part where she talks about how she doesn't, writers do this sometimes. I did it for a long time. And you keep a pen and a notebook next to your bed, because when you're just about to fall asleep, some brilliant sentence or brilliant word or brilliant idea will come to you, and you sort of sketch it out and then go to sleep, and because you don't want to forget it when you wake up. And she says that she doesn't do that. Because she always believed that if it was the right sentence, it would come back to her. And as profound and as elaborate as I thought that was, as a writer, it kind of gave me anxiety, because I thought, what? No. What?
No, it won't.
It's gone forever and ever and ever. So I'm trying it. It's still a work in progress. I still don't fully trust myself with that, but you know, Toni Morrison was a genius, and I'm willing to give her the benefit of the doubt on this.
Yes, she definitely deserves the benefit of the doubt.
You know what I mean? Right? So like, yeah, but I'm reading myself, because I did it for so many years. I also had that little like just a pen and a paper in case that sleep sentence comes in.
Yeah,
but that's how I manage that anxiety, is journaling and keeping a little notebook with me just for inspiration if it strikes.
Yeah, I feel like that's a great sort of advice for any traveler, right? Whether you want to do something with the content or not, it's kind of nice to have. Yeah, I'm a good old fashioned like pen and paper guy myself too.
Yeah,
you know, like the. Yeah, I like the pen and the paper.
Yeah. Thing,
you know, I don't know. Yeah. Something, one less screen to look at, I guess.
True story. True story.
Well, I so appreciate your time, and I just loved getting to have this conversation with you. Again, I'll mention the book, Traveling While Black, Essays Inspired by a Life on the Move. Nanjala, it's been a real pleasure. Do you have any, like if you want to share any websites or anything where people can find you, feel free to do that.
I'm on Twitter a lot. Some might say too much. And that's always a fun place to engage with people. And I do a lot of, you know, like you heard, do a lot of interesting work in different fields. I do have other books out on different subjects. I check those out if you have a chance. My first book is about digital democracy and analog politics. And it is about Kenya, but it's more broadly a story about how technology is changing the way we do politics. And I wrote it before the US and UK elections. So it's really interesting to look back at all the stuff that's happened since then and think, yeah, this happened to us 2 years before it happened to you. And so if you want to keep that momentum up of learning about how other places can be complicated and have lives that are not necessarily measured relative to Europe, that might be a good place to start.
Thanks for putting out the important work that you're doing and for taking the time to just share with us today. And yeah, I just really appreciate it. And I hope that maybe we can have a conversation in person one day. I don't know if you ever come through Norway. I'm in Oslo, Norway. So if you're ever coming through, or if I'm ever coming through your town, then
please,
it would be great.
Yes,
that would be wonderful. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
There you have it, my conversation with Nanjala. Thank you so very much for your time, Nanjala. And please pick up this book if you get a chance, Traveling While Black. It's a very diverse book in many ways. You know, a lot of travel books just focus on the travel, right? But again, as you heard in the conversation, she's talking about a lot of global issues. And I really think the back of her book sums it up best. These are thoughtful, original reflections on migration and identity from an African woman abroad. And it says, what does it feel like to move through a world designed to limit and exclude you? What are the joys and pains of holidays for people of color when guidebooks are never written with them in mind? How many Black lives today are impacted by the othering legacy of colonial cultures and policies? What can travel tell us about our sense of self, of home, of belonging, and identity? And why has the world order become hostile to human mobility, as old as humanity itself, when more people are on the move than ever? And that's just right from the back of the book here, and sums it up pretty well. So, I don't know, fascinating book and fascinating individual. Thanks again to Nanjala for stopping by the show. And, you know, she touched on this idea of her relationship with fear. How did travel change that? That's something we talked about during the interview segment. And, you know, that really got me thinking, of course, personally, what that means to me. You know, if I ask myself that question, how has travel changed my relationship to fear? And I'm not sure if I'm able to articulate this properly, but I would say that it was a game changer. If I had to use one word, I guess that's a hyphenated word. Okay, you're calling me out. Is that two words? Is a hyphenated word two words or one word? Anyway, is game changer even hyphenated? Whatever. We're not talking about grammar here. It was a game changer, right? Because you're thrown into situations and you're thrown out into the world and you're all of a sudden confronted with, you know, whatever, situations, people, things that you've never been around in your life, right? And with some of those things comes fear, right? Whether it's a visceral fear of maybe walking down a dark street in a city you're not familiar with at 2 o'clock in the morning, trying to figure out where the hell you are because you're lost and you can't find your hostel. Not that that ever happened. It happened a lot. Or being jumped by a gang of robbers, which is something that happened to be on my first backpacking trip. You know, those are pretty easy things to kind of point out. But also, you know, it's like sort of the everyday fears of, well, maybe I don't know where I'm going to sleep, or, you know, landing in a city, not being able to find a place to stay. you know, all of these sort of things that you might not be used to within the comforts and confines of your home, where everything's sort of set up and easy and you can go downstairs and take a hot shower and, you know, chances are nobody's going to come into your home and do anything to you, you know, fairly safe in your home town. You kind of know where things are, you know, then you get out into the wild world and it's like, bam, anything can happen at any moment. And you have to recalibrate to that. And I think that's what one of the things travel did for me. You recalibrate in a different way and you're exposed to so much that you're inevitably going to come across things or have run-ins with people, places, or things that bring up fears, right? And then you have to, you're in the situation, there's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. You have to kind of push through and overcome them. And it just builds a certain muscle. Again, this is very hard to articulate and this is obviously different for each person. But for me, it was a game changer, right? It just gave me a lot of confidence in different ways that I could overcome certain things. So I would love to hear from you. How has travel changed your relationship with fear? Again, you can send me a voice memo. Just open up the app on your phone and email to jason@zerototravel.com or go to zerototravel.com/speak. It's a real easy link. You just hit a record button. You have 90 seconds to make a recording and you can leave me a message there and maybe we'll put you on the podcast. But I'd love to hear, how has travel changed your relationship to fear? I probably do a whole episode on that. I feel like I have a lot more to say and stories to tell and things like that. So if you want that, let me know. But, you know, I'll leave it at that. I'll leave it at that. I know you're busy. You got some stuff to do today. So, but before I let you go, you know, I got to say thanks to somebody who took the time to go to that link, zerototravel.com/speak, and leave me a message. That was Mayla. And she left me this message. I don't know if you remember in the last episode, I was asking you what I should do with my country's patch collection. And she gave me some advice. So I'll play that message now.
Hi, Jason. My name's Mayla. I emailed you a couple months back about right when I was leaving to go teach English in South Korea. And I'm about 4 months in, and so far it's going really well. I am itching to travel some more, but it's a good situation until travel opens up, I guess. Anyways, I recently listened to your podcast where you talked about collecting patches during your travels, and I do the exact same thing. I have like a collection stored up. And my plan is to find the perfect pair of jeans to put them on. I'm still looking for the jeans, but I have faith one day they'll come through. But my backup is to put them on a jean jacket, so that's also an option. You got to find a nice piece of denim that you can keep. That's my advice. Anyways, thanks for all that you do. I've really been enjoying listening to your podcast while I'm itching more and more to get back out there and explore. Anyways, have a good one. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks, Mayla. Okay, there you go. Vote for the jeans or a jean jacket. You know, I do have a pretty awesome old corduroy jacket. Maybe that could be the thing. I don't know. I got a lot of patches, you know. It'd be pretty blinged out, I must say. But let me experiment with that. I'll pull out my old patch collection, see what I can throw it on. I think my original idea was like to put them all on a bandana or something and hang them on the wall. But you know, they're wearable, right? I do got some jeans with some holes in them, legit holes, not the kind of holes where they, you know, cut them for fashion reasons. You've seen that, right? Yeah. You buy a pair of jeans and they're already ripped. Like, I don't know how that works. How does that work? Does somebody just sit in the factory and like hand cut those things? And we're like, all right, this looks cool. Anyway, all my jeans have holes in them from, I don't know, rolling around on the ground and doing stuff, I guess. But maybe I should use some of these patches to patch up my jeans. I could spread them across the entire clothing collection, which isn't very large, but anyway, enough about the patch collection. thanks for your advice. Don't forget, before I let you go, if you haven't done so yet, please sign up over at zerototravel.com. Join the newsletter list. You can find out about all the happenings going on off the podcast, workshops, and you know the newsletter that I send out. I try to send it out weekly. Usually it ends up being bi-weekly, but do a nice roundup of some interesting things that I find online, talk a little travel. We'll share the latest podcast episodes with you and things like that. So I'd love to stay in touch with you there. Just go to zerototravel.com, sign up, and then you can join the email newsletter. Right now I have a bonus audio file, three best ways to save money for travel that you'll get when you sign up. Okay, let me pull out a quote here from the drawer, the old drawer, the old quote drawer. Okay, this is from Dogen Zenji, one of my faves. Enlightenment is intimacy with all things. Boom! Mind blown. Enlightenment is intimacy with all things. Oh, I have a lot to say about that, but I'm not going to do it today. I'm going to let you go. Smile, have a wonderful day. Take a chance today. Do something that fills your soul with goodness. You know, write a good friend a letter, or call somebody up you haven't talked to and tell them you love them, or take a little day trip for yourself. Do something for you. Take a little you time. Thanks so much for listening, and I will see you next time. Cheers.
This podcast has been brought to you by ZeroToTravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.